The Last Bohemians LA. Unexpected stories from Maverick women.
Hello, I'm Kate Hutchinson, and this is the audio series that takes you on a hallucinatory, impressionistic trip through extraordinary women's lives, as told by them. For this season, after three series based in the UK, I went out to Los Angeles and stationed myself in Hollywood with producer Holly Fisher on a mission to meet some of the raddest, baddest artists who just so happened to be over 60. Now, this next interviewee, I actually chased all the way from London to LA. We did one interview in Claridge's in Mayfair, and then we did another months later at an eerily empty Chateau Marmont, which is the rather legendary rock and roll hotel on Sunset Boulevard. And there are none more rock and roll, in fashion anyway, than Michelle Lamy. Before you meet Michelle, I just want to shout out our amazing sponsors, Audio-Technica, who kitted us out for this series with their superb quality mics and headphones. They're celebrating 60 years in the audio game this year, so go on, get yourself a birthday present over at audio-technica.com.
I'm very interested of what kind of question you are going to ask me. You have been doing this with women, mainly. This is your thing, and is to talk about women that you think are... How do you think they are, the women? How do you choose them?
I'm drawn to people who are pushing something forward, who are living life outside the norm, whether it's in their approach to life, the art they've created. I'm interested in women that have a strong image, but mainly I'm interested in women that don't give a fuck.
When it comes to women with an unforgettable image, you'd be hard-pressed to find one more striking than Michelle Lamy. She's been called witchy, ageless, a shaman, and the ultimate eccentric, with her signature gold teeth, ink-dipped fingers, cigarette in hand, and a streak of coal down her forehead. Oh, and she's usually always dressed in a sculptural design by her husband, the fashion designer Rick Owens. She's often referred to as her younger husband's muse, but Michelle is a chameleonic creative and enigmatic polymath in her own right. She's a performer, party thrower, a sort of arts facilitator who organises happenings in places like the Venice Biennale, and she's been designing furniture for over a decade, with Kim Kardashian among her clients. As a young woman growing up in France, Michelle trained as a lawyer and studied with the famous French philosopher Charles Deleuze, whose concepts, and I hope I get this right, included that art should be open, chaotic, organic, and boundless, and that to live well is to fully express one's power and limitless potential without worrying what anyone else thinks. Before Michelle relocated back to Paris and was the toast of the global fashion world, she lived in LA for 28 years, where she first ran her own clothing label and then started the cult Hollywood hangout Le Deux Café. In the late 90s and early 2000s, this was the place to be seen. Lamy would often perform Langston Hughes poems with a jazz ensemble for her ultra-cool habitués. Her seductive allure and confrontational style has fascinated people ever since. My French accent is terrible, sorry. And Michelle's is so thick, but I love it. She speaks elliptically, sketching out big ideas and then returning to them without you hardly noticing. Anyone expecting a straightforward conversation might want to skip this one. But that's also the beauty of Michelle. She's a totally free spirit who won't be hemmed in. I feel very lucky and grateful to have spent two afternoons in her company as I try to figure out what makes one of the most radical minds in fashion tick.
Is there a thread that runs through all of the different things that you do? Because you've been a restaurateur, a party host, happening maker, a performance artist, a front woman of a band.
Yeah, there is certainly a thread. Otherwise, you know, there is a long time I would say to be schizophrenic. I'm counting on you to find it.
You are often called a style icon, but who were your style icons growing up, Michelle?
I don't know what is a style icon. I discover and what I really think it is when the first time I went in North Africa. I went in Tunisia when I was in at university. I had some friends who were shooting a movie and they told me, oh, you know your way around. I was to find some location for them. And 3 weeks later, I was under a tent with some Berber people that there is not so many even at that time who still live like this. And we were playing music on some plastic buckets. And I thought these women were the most stylish in the world. And I still think this way. You know, the thing that I always like, the skins that have been buried by the time, these eyes, and obviously you can see that's my idea of style. And it's something I like with the nomad, and you carry everything on you, like all your bracelets and everything, because I like the idea that you go somewhere but you don't know when you're going to come back. But, and it's true that I'm attracted to this, but as much as I'm attracted to any culture, or civilization that go with music, because my Berber side comes from my father's side.
You mentioned the Berber women, but also you and your mother being a big inspiration, and also Louise Bourgeois. Why were you drawn to these older women in particular?
Of course, Louise is in love with Louise Bourgeois. She's one of the greatest artists ever. And then she had been, like it happened a lot for women, even if she was an artist from day one, and she's super famous at 85. But somebody like this, of course, we can only be hopeful and whatever and seeing what she did. I mean, if she's a woman, or she's an incredible artist. So at the same time, it's a beautiful woman, but it's not because she's a beautiful woman artist. She's a fantastic artist.
I think that one of the things that people admire you for, and maybe, you know, it's quite rare, is that you look your age. We're living in a world where there's pressure to look younger. There's pressure to adapt our faces.
The women, it come and goes. I know, you know, it was, we're talking in May 68, and we had burned our bra, we got the pill. It seems now we are in the hole again, the women. We really have to be, okay, so you have to push.
That's why I found it interesting that you're working with Kim, because she seems, in some ways, like your polar opposite.
Yeah, well, I don't feel this way at all. I think she has, you know, doing things like for harmony, for the women that we think. This family is a phenomena of our time.
Do you have a routine? Do you have daily rituals? Or is everything different every day?
The tea and cigarette is going to be a routine that always exists in the morning. But I'm going to try to do boxing as much as I can do. And then I'm very enthusiastic with work I've been doing. You know that with the furniture that make me go through the world and doing installation and everything. That's interesting. No, but I have different routines because lately I moved a lot in different places. Perhaps it's the time, feeling like I'm like this innocent 20-year-old who is trying to reinvent something.
How important is it to you to project this image of a strong woman? And is boxing part of that?
But if you saw me in a ring, I don't really look that strong. I look elegant doing it, but I'm not. I don't think so. I'm not thinking about this. I think in the boxing, it's the fact you look at somebody in the eyes and you stand for what you believe. And then you dance around somebody and you find the thing to go. We are not talking about the killer monster, you know. We all need to feel good in our body and everything. And for me, the box adds something to it. And I love the ambiance of the thing, of those. You know, it's also something for the head. You know, some people have yoga and that is not me at all. The only time I slapped somebody in the street for no reason, it was coming for my one class of yoga. I said, okay, this is not working for me.
Why did you slap them?
I don't know. I don't remember, but I know. Perhaps he just pushed me or something. No, nothing, you know. For no reason, I said. There was no good reason.
When you chose to get gold teeth, were you ready for how it was going to change your appearance?
No, but you know, it started here. It's with that story with you have to have your feeling change. And I found this Jewish dentist here. I started all the teeth there, and he was putting like little diamond in it for the light and doing something interesting. So then, after all this money, then I said, this is very silly, I have all this, and I like, but cannot see it, even me, I cannot. So with him, I said, okay, we have to do something in the front. And so you see, it was a good reason. It was for health. And then it became interesting to continue because my teeth in the front had no problem and no feeling to change and no nothing and were super. In fact, when I see pictures now, it's like, oh, they were really, really good. Well, like good in the sense of white teeth in the front. But also I was thinking, you know, I smoke all the time, so then metal is better.
Where did you learn to not give a shit?
You think I don't give a shit? I give a lot of shit for a lot of things. I give a shit because I want to be able to do and to create things with a lot of people, but keeping everything with them together. I love this thing. It's just a tribe. I think it's just to be a tribe, and I think it's also your style. I'm imagining this tribe, and I like that the way I did. So this is not style, is it? To be yourself.
Why did you move to LA?
I moved to LA because I wanted to move to the States. I was going a lot to New York and coming back when I had no more money. And then I got convinced by my brother that it would better to be in LA because it was like New York on the Riviera, but I needed less money. You look at the Pacific Ocean, the rest of the world at a point doesn't exist. I mean, this is place to be. There was always this spirit. I mean, all the artists of our generation are coming from California. Things were cheaper.
When you moved there, you started your fashion label. Then you met Rick, who became your pattern maker for a while. And then the label became his name.
He had good reason.
Why did you decide to push him forward and take a step back yourself?
Because I was already in going more things. If I was trying to make a crème brûlée and then a five-star chef is coming and want to make it, I'm not going to push to make my crème brûlée. That's why. But I'm going to have to eat it and to stay around at the table.
But you remained a sort of, you know, a collaborator and a real driving force. Yeah. Was there ever a time when you felt frustrated that you were referred to as Rick's wife or as his muse, purely as that?
But it's a way to express things, you know, for things that I think are not important. I'm sure it was more at the beginning, not at the beginning in LA, but at the beginning coming to Europe and all this. But now I'm talking all the time, I'm performing, I'm thinking I am the one with the vision. So I'm happy.
What was the night like there at your club?
They say that I revamp Hollywood Boulevard, trying to create a club. I had to build it from a parking lot. Then Rick had a studio across the street. Everybody saw it became like this part of Hollywood. At the time, it was a little scary to start to get there because it was a not a safe place next to the most creative people being around on the hills. So I was, with Bobby Wood, we had started to sing there a little with some jazz. That's where I started, and it was a very free, where people could do things. It was a gathering and all Asian Hollywood without being Hollywood, because there is a lot of creative people here. Well, you have to trust your gut feeling, and then it works for everybody. When you have an idea, there is a lot of things you don't like. There is also something, a reaction. It's a reaction how the world could be better if you were doing it this way, that you can trust your instinct for a while. That should be the world with some spirits that go with you.
How do you choose which project to focus on next?
The project are choosing me. Cannot go for something, but usually I think that's the way I think I'm sort of psychic in the story. Because it seemed at the right time and the right mood and something happened, it's the proposal of the right project. You know, you have also to have your journey through people that are pushing you or dragging you in and expressing. I like chaos because it's where I get ideas. I've been always willing to sort of explore the world and be seduced by so many things when I think I can create something with it.
What do you think seduces people about you?
I think it's a romance, some kind of romance, or I like to get, or I feel that I get a little bit into their world without changing myself or continuing a song. You know, I always say that my philosophy is 1001 nights. You have always to say a story every night, otherwise you are going to cut your throat. So perhaps I'm afraid if I don't get a story every day. But no. I like collaboration. So I like to have a lot of affair, if you want to know the thing. That's what it is. And the first sense, like people organize to do a collaboration. Mm-hmm. It's like being the life. And you know, it's something, it's because I'm old. I'm not little girl, even if I don't feel this way at all.
You don't feel old?
No.
How old do you feel?
Oh, I don't know. I don't count. I think everybody is somebody and know who they are after 35. After that, the age don't count.
I'm 35 now. I think I'm still figuring it out.
You are who you are now. You are going to be doing a lot of things, and you're asking people questions they don't know what to answer.
I get the sense that you love talking about the work and all the different projects you're doing, but you don't like talking about yourself so much. That's the sense I get.
What I like are stories. So I like to tell you stories and you figure it out. It's not, I can't talking about. No, because it's me and me and me this and that.
That's what I'm interested in, though. The line on your forehead, does that keep you centered?
The day I did it, I don't know how it came on, but I cannot live without it. I get up, it's the first thing I do, and it needs to be there.
When did you start to feel like you were appreciated?
It seemed that officially is pretty recent, or at least everything had been accelerating. You know, it was because I was perhaps certainly becoming more myself. The big thing that changed me is meeting Deleuze. You know, because of the centuries, they are often expressing themselves a new thing after 20 years. So 2020 was the time of really, I think it started to see that we should have another way of thinking, even if right now I'm telling you it's a big bump of, because we thought our communication with the internet, we are in the middle of something of the old world, but at the same time, everything is happening that people want to, what I always felt that I didn't know exactly which sex I was, or color, or, well, it's not, I don't know, but I want to belong. When I'm in the, even if I'm in the subway in Paris, people will talk to me in saying a few words in Arabic. But when I was in India, people thought I could be in India also. But somewhere there is this thing, like to fit, I like to be embracing what I feel is happening there, that I can be part of it.
On the flip side, how do you feel about that phrase, cultural appropriation?
What is that?
Where you appropriate other cultures. I just wondered if you'd heard that phrase and what you thought of it.
Yeah, but there is a lot of... I'm saying this for blending in some part that are so limited. You know, we are not sharing the world with, but at the same time, it's physically, it belongs. I think I can also belong, doesn't matter in a way. And you know, sometimes it's perhaps scary, especially after you ask me all those questions, to say, but do really I know who I am? But most of the time, I wake up in the morning, I'm all excited. I think I'm going to do this, there is this to do, and then there is Friday, and think we can have a lot of little creation. It's why I like this world of, that fit me, this Instagram world, in a way, because it's those vignettes, and then when they come together, they help something. I'm very much for this. I'm not for the big novel. It is like I like short stories where you can invent something. I like when, you know, it's like the music, it starts, it's one show, then it goes to another one. And so then, yeah, perhaps one day, but perhaps does it matter?
Michelle, when you asked me why I did this podcast series, yeah, and I told you about the sorts of women that I'm interested in, what did you think when I said that list?
But that's why I was wondering. I mean, I was very impressed that you chose me to be in this list.
Why were you impressed?
You know, I don't know, it's a little surprise, and then that does not say I won't say no, say yes.
This episode was recorded by Sifa Niki, edited by Mariana Sousa Aguiar, and presented by me, Kate Hutchinson. The Last Bohemians LA is kindly supported by Audio Technica, who are celebrating 60 years in business this year. They're a family-owned Japanese brand with a passion for pure quality audio. Discover their awesome products like headphones and microphones at audio-technica.com or at audiotechnica_EU on Instagram. A huge thank you to Janet Fishgrund and Owens Kaur and Matilda Hill Jenkins for the portrait photography. Check us out on Instagram at The Last Bohemians Pod. And if you feel like it, leave us a review. Every review counts.